This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good evening. This is Dr. Everett Piper, President of Oklahoma Wesleyan University in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, filling in for Tony Perkins this evening. June 21st, 2017, about 5:05 in the afternoon, if you're on the East Coast, or the evening, I should say. And again, remember, a little housekeeping here before we get going with a big lineup for the day. The call-in number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234, here at Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, Dr. Everett Piper, President of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, Bartlesville, Oklahoma, filling in for Tony again. The lineup for the day. This is the summer solstice. You know that. June 21st is the longest day of the year. Well, last night was a bit of a long night again for the Democrats. They lost, again, a special election. We're going to have Congressman Jody Heiss of Georgia here because the special election took place in Georgia. We're going to have him here to discuss his thoughts on Karen Handel's special election victory in the Peach State. As we go into the quarter hour, after 15 minutes after the hour or thereabout, we're going to talk about the Department of Education says educators could be investigated and penalized under the auspices of Title IX if we don't refer to transgender students by their preferred pronoun, a pronoun that they establish for themselves based on their quote-unquote gender identity, one that in many cases, especially in the transgender argument, in all cases, is biologically incorrect, scientifically fallacious. It is pandering to their dysphoria, and it is not attending to reality. But yet, we're being told by the Department of Education, places like Oklahoma Wesleyan University, Christian institutions, that we can be penalized after investigation for failing to comply with these preferred pronouns. We're going to have Greg Baylor of the Alliance Defending Freedom here to discuss this issue with us. As we go into the bottom of the hour, we will talk with an author that I have fallen in love with this week. His name is Peter Boileau. He has written a book titled The Abandoned Generation, Why Whatever Is Not Enough. Fascinating book on the millennial generation and the whateverism, the nihilism, the intellectual mush that is prevailing in our schools, in our culture, and what is happening to the millennial generation and those that follow as the result of the whateverism and abandoning this generation to literal nonsense, because this stuff makes no sense. All right, we have the first segment coming up here. And again, my introduction is as follows. Republican Karen Handel is the winner of Georgia's special congressional election. Handel defeated Democrat John Ossoff, 53-47%. The race came in as the most expensive congressional race in United States history, spending as much as Ronald Reagan spent in 1984 to win the presidency. Joining us right now with his reaction to this election is Jody Heiss. He represents the 5th District of Georgia and serves as a member of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee and Vice Chairman of the Subcommittee on Government Operations for the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Congressman, welcome to Washington Watch again.
Always great to be on with you. Thank you very much.
Well, sorry you have to talk to me rather than Tony, but I think you can deal with it.
And I'm honored to be on here with you.
Well, you're from Atlanta. I understand that you were born there. By the way, sidebar, you went to Asbury College, is that correct?
Asbury College, absolutely.
Asbury College would be considered a sister institution of Oklahoma Wesleyan, cut out of the holiness tradition, and honored to have an alumnus from the fine institution of Asbury College to join us right now.
Well,
you've got a good education.
Thank you so much.
All right. Handel takes over the House seat belonging to Tom Price, who left to become President Trump's health secretary. $23 million spent on Ossoff's campaign. Going through a couple other notes here. This is the 5th special election in a row that the Republicans have won, and this happens even after all of this outside money being pumped into the state, $750,000 from Planned Parenthood alone. I want to let you run with this and tell us what you think we should be learning as we watch these special elections, and in particular, this one.
Listen, there's so much. There's so many different avenues we can run down this thing. I cannot help but think, though, that the Democrat Party and their leadership woke up this morning with a keen understanding of bankruptcy from multiple perspectives. I mean, $30 million plus spent on Ossoff, all for nothing. You realize he ended up with less percentage in this race than he did back in April in the primary. So you've got 30 whatever million dollars spent, and they actually lost ground in this thing. So totally bankrupt in that perspective. But the broader picture has to be why. This was to be a referendum on the president, as were the other four or five races that you mentioned. Now they are 0-5. This is absolutely a slam dunk towards the Democrat Party. They've got to do some serious soul searching. They are running as rapidly as they can to the left. And the further and the more rapidly they run to the left, the more radical they become, and end result, the more radically irrelevant they become. And that's what's happening.
Now, when they run to the left, we know that the endorsements from the radical left of the Democratic Party and the radical left of our political establishment in the United States, Bernie Sanders, for example, every candidate he's endorsed essentially has lost, including himself, I would argue. So when will the left wake up and recognize that the socialist argument that they're making, the big government arguments that they're making, the total control, the totalitarian regime, really, because it is. They want total control over all of our lives, from how do we use the bathroom to where we send our kids to school to the curriculum that our kids are subjected to in those schools. So this totalitarianism is not resonating, apparently. Why do you think they don't listen to that?
Well, I really can't answer that, not being a Democrat, but you're exactly right. You look at their leadership, and they are radically left of America, and the American people time and again reject that ideology, and they've done it yet again in the race that was to them. It was everything. This was going to be the race of all races to do away with the president's agenda and so forth, and they lost yet again, and lost in greater numbers than anyone anticipated. But I am not sure that they are capable of changing the direction. And again, this is just personal speculation. They have bit into their ideology hook, line, and sinker, and I don't know that they have so much invested in the socialistic, as you described it. I don't know that they're capable of shifting gears at this time to come back more to the center of America. So I have no idea what's going to happen, but it is clearly evident that the further they continue running to the left, the more the Americans reject them.
Let me push back a little, play devil's advocate here. Some are saying, yeah, you Republicans can celebrate these victories, but they're very narrow. You're winning by very narrow margins, which proves that our agenda, the Democratic agenda, is being heard. And when the millennials start voting, especially in the next general election for the presidency, you're going to see a wave of discontent, much akin to what we just saw in Great Britain when all of these young people came out to vote. They've had it with this conservatism. They've had it with Donald Trump, and these close elections are proving it. What say you?
You know, I agree somewhat that it is concerning how close some of these races are, but I can tell you firsthand with this, with Karen Handel and Ossoff, he tried to pull the wool over the eyes of the citizens of the 6th District of Georgia. His ads tried to portray him as a conservative, but it didn't work. He was revealed for what he is. He's a fraud. He's a strong liberal who was trying to convince people he was a conservative. And then once being here in Washington, no question, he would have fallen right in line with the Democrat leadership. But, you know, the question is, the Democrat Party, as it's going, cannot reveal who they really are and what they really believe. They always, if you watch them, always try to present themselves as more conservative as they really are. And I believe as the American people become more familiarized and more educated with the reality of what the party as a whole represents, the more they will be rejected and in greater numbers.
Now, I'm going to stick with this issue of the younger voter for a second here. We know that Young Republicans Convention, I may have the name of that particular event wrong, but they had Bruce Jenner, i.e. Caitlyn Jenner, speak at a Republican convention for the Young Republicans just last week. What is going on? Why in the world would the leadership within the Republican Party sanction that? Because I'm a social conservative, not just a fiscal conservative. I believe in pro-life. I believe in pro-traditional values in marriage. I believe the laws of nature and nature's God. I believe that we are endowed by our creator with certain unalienable rights, and that implies there is a creator, and I'm not it. I'm not God. God's God. I believe there's so many, like yourself, conservative Republicans who embrace the traditional biblical worldview, Judeo-Christian ethic. And when we see some of our younger Republican leadership going to the left when it comes to the social issues and having Bruce Jenner speak on the platform at a Republican convention, it causes concern.
It does cause concern, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And, you know, I think there's an effort overall to reach out, to broaden the umbrella, so to speak. And I think that's always a disturbing thing. You broaden it too widely, you know, you're gonna get stuff like this. But, you know, personally, I go back to, what are these young people being taught from the family? What are they being taught in schools? What are they being taught in the churches? And I think there's a great area of concern just overall with the Christian, Judeo-Christian worldview that is lacking in what is being taught to the upcoming generation. And that's one reason I'm so supportive of repealing the Johnson Amendment. You know, I'm tired of the government telling churches and nonprofits and Christian institutions and so forth what they can and cannot say, what they can and cannot teach, with fear of potentially losing tax-exempt status. We have got to be able to protect and maintain the liberty to educate the upcoming generation on all these things. Are those social issues of life and marriage and so forth, as well as other principles that are important to us as a Republican Party. So, you know, there are a lot of factors involved, but we've got to get back to the basics of defending our liberties and educating them beginning at a young age.
Well, and also schools like your alma mater, Asbury College, and the institution that I'm the president of, Oklahoma Wesleyan University, we need to be left alone by the federal government. I should not be imposed, and your alma mater should not be imposed upon and forced to buy into the transgender accommodation issue, which is the Department of Education and Office of Civil Rights, as you know, is sending us Dear Colleague letters telling us that even as Christian institutions, we have to provide transgender accommodations on our campuses or we'll be subject to being investigated for violations of Title IX.
Right.
I cannot teach a Judeo-Christian ethic. I cannot teach a biblical worldview if the federal government is going to penalize me under the auspices of Title IX for admitting that a female is a biological fact and not a fabrication of a dysphoric male.
My point, exactly. I mean, that is precisely what I'm getting to, and I think we've got to get government off the backs of the First Amendment. I mean, and off the backs of those who have deeply held religious beliefs and convictions. It is not up to the government to come in and to police thoughts and to police what we believe with the punishment and the harassment that comes along with it.
Thank you, Congressman. Going to have to take a break here. Thank you for taking the time to join us. I know you're very busy.
Congressman, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the Department of Education and their Dear Colleague letter. Greg Baylor from the Alliance Defending Freedom will be joining us to guide us through this issue right after this break.
One of the great freedoms that most Americans enjoy is the ability to get involved in political campaigns. But what about pastors? Unfortunately, due to a little-known amendment that was passed in 1954 at President Lyndon Johnson's urging, churches and other nonprofit organizations are prohibited from making statements for or against a candidate for public office if they want to remain tax-exempt. This is just one of the many problems with the Johnson Amendment. Not only does fear of IRS action put a chill on the free speech of pastors, it restrains other nonprofit organizations from participating in the debate of public policy in their area of expertise. In addition, the IRS only rarely enforces the Johnson Amendment, causing widespread confusion about what constitutes lawful political speech and what doesn't. For more information on how to amend the Johnson Amendment, visit frc.org/Johnson Amendment. That's frc.org/Johnson Amendment.
Your mission is to find Granny and get that sauce.
Affirmative.
1 million moms in association with American Family Studios introduces Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent.
I'm Ryan DeFrady's. I work alone.
Ryan is arrogant and reckless until the day he's paired with a very unlikely partner.
No way! I can do this alone, without anyone's help, much less my mom's.
Look, Ryan.
She's my mom!
Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent is the new action-adventure series featuring a young spy with a whole lot to learn.
Mama's coming, sweetie!
She's an agent! Get her, boys!
Each exciting, fun-filled episode teaches children important values, like honoring parents and respecting authority. And there's a brief wrap-up at the end that connects the story to a biblical illustration. Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent. Perfect for children ages 6 and over. Order yours today at ryansecretagent.com.
A charitable gift annuity through the AFA Foundation is an excellent way to provide yourself with guaranteed permanent income while at the same time supporting the American Family Association. Here's what one supporter told us.
I very much want to see God's word continue into the next generation. This is a way I can help AFA spread the truth and promote their biblical stand. My experience with the AFA Foundation continues to remind me that I have a small part in helping AFA in the battle for our nation's values.
Financial planning is essential to your family. A charitable gift annuity through the AFA Foundation is one way you can support AFA and the health of our nation. The planners at the AFA Foundation are here to help you do the most with your finances. You can call us at 800-326-4543, extension 345, find us on Facebook, or email foundation@afa.net, and learn whether a charitable gift annuity is right for you.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University here. Remember that the call-in number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. I will be taking calls in the last 15 minutes of the program as we go into the final stretch between quarter of the hour and the top of the hour. What I'd like to talk about right now is something obviously very, very important to me. It's the United States Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, the DOE and the OCR, and the fact that they have issued a Dear Colleague letter, a memo to schools stating that if we refuse to refer to the so-called transgender student by the preferred pronoun, that we can be investigated for being in violation of Title IX. Now, I remind you that Title IX is a 1972 law that was established to give women equal access to facilities, primarily sports, but other areas of college and high school and scholastic life too. So I've said it before on this program, I'm going to say it again now. How can I give women equal access to anything if the federal government is now requiring that I deny that they're a fact, that I pretend, that I engage in make-believe, and that I enable someone else who wants to fabricate female identity out of thin air, a dysphoric male who wants to raise his hand on a given day and say, I'm a woman. What they're saying to us now, via their Dear Colleague letter, is that we must comply with these preferred gender-neutral pronouns, or a pronoun that aligns with the defined, self-defined gender identity of a transgender student. And with us right now is Greg Baylor. Greg is with the Alliance Defending Freedom. Not only is he an excellent attorney, and he's the director of ADF's Center for Religious Schools, he's also a friend, and he's represented Oklahoma Wesleyan University in our defense of our First Amendment rights. Greg, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Dr. Piper, it's always great to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining me right now. I always interpret this stuff in layman's language rather than legalese and lawyer talk, and I don't know if that's good or bad. So you might want to correct something I've said. I don't think so, but you certainly can add detail and give us an explanation of what's going on here. I guess my first question is this letter just is it the same language that was always in the old letter that the Obama administration issued, or is there new language in this? Explain this to us.
Well, as always, you've done an excellent job explaining the legal materials, but I'll try to give a little bit more context to it. As many of your listeners know, back in the Obama administration, they sent a so-called Dear Colleague letter to essentially every educational institution that receives government money, telling them that Title IX now reaches gender identity and that they have an obligation to open up facilities, the private facilities, dormitories, sports teams, and all the other things that you mentioned, based on subjective gender identity rather than on biological sex. That was, of course, a source of great consternation. There was litigation. A lot of religious schools responded by obtaining religious exemption from Title IX. But the election changed things, and many of us hoped that President Trump would take action to rescind that guidance. And his administration did do that. In February of this year, they sent out another letter saying, hey, remember that letter that the Obama administration sent out? Well, we're withdrawing that, but we want to take a second look at this issue. And what we're dealing with now, the thing that's news today, is a letter that's not from the department to every school in America like the Dear Colleague letter, but rather a letter from the Office for Civil Rights at the Education Department to the regional directors of the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. And it's telling them what they think Title IX means. And the distinction that they draw, which I think is really critical, is that they respect the idea that schools can maintain private facilities, restrooms, locker rooms, and the like, based on biological sex, without violating Title IX, but other aspects of the transgender guidance that was issued by the Obama administration, apparently in their eyes, are still in effect. And you referred specifically to the idea that Title IX, apparently in the eyes of the new administration, requires covered institutions to refer to transgender people by their preferred names and pronouns. So this is a really, I would say, a surprising development, and it's fraught with difficulty.
Well, and I'm going to read a quote from this letter from President Trump's administration, not Barack Obama's. The quote is, refusing to use a transgender student's preferred name or pronouns when the school uses preferred names for gender-conforming students, or when the refusal is motivated by animus toward people who do not conform to sex stereotypes. Now, part of that is poorly crafted, in my view. It's a messy sentence that's confusing, and I don't know if that's on purpose or not. But the way I read it, Greg, is that if we refuse to use the preferred pronoun of a transgender student, we will be held in violation of Title IX and subject to the accusation that we have created animus toward people who do not conform to our view of sex stereotypes, which is biology. Am I reading it right?
I think that's essentially right. I think what they would say is, well, you're only forbidden from you're only required to use preferred pronouns if your refusal to do so is rooted in animus. So
who decides that?
Non-animus reason, it's okay. But I think you and I both know that the definition of animus is going to be a very low bar. I mean, I think we saw what the Supreme Court talked about, the motivation behind states crafting marriage laws to reflect reality and reflect a created order. Those laws were said to be rooted in animus. So I'm not sure that that's much of a protection for those of us who would like to use sort of, you know, the right pronouns to refer to.
You and I know, and everybody else listening to this knows, that we have confused and conflated definition of terms over and over again. Left is right and right is left, and up is down and down is up, and male is female and female is male. And animus is disagreement, and disagreement is now animus. So that anytime I disagree with somebody, they're going to claim that it's hateful or full of animus. Correct? You got 30 seconds.
That's right. And I think the other surprising thing that I've seen here, and I think this is the first time I've seen this, they basically say that if a school agrees to use a name for a student that they prefer, for a gender-conforming student, then they have an obligation to refer to a transgender student by the name that they prefer. Let me explain what I think that means. So
quickly,
suppose
Greg,
you have a student whose birth name on the birth certificate is Margaret, and they prefer to be called Peggy. As I understand it, if a school is willing to call that student Peggy, that means they now have an obligation under Title IX to call
John, who thinks he's Sally, they have to call him Sally now. I think that's what that means.
And
that
Greg, thank you so much for joining us and helping us with this. Woe unto him who calls evil good and good evil. That's what I have to say to this.
Making the most of your money, here's Dan Celia.
Oil prices continue to hover around a seven-month low. Investors, this is the interesting part, folks, investors are weighing up supply issues. I really don't know how it could be possible that investors are just now getting around to thinking that there could be supply issues. I've been talking about supply concerns now since January, and it was extremely unlikely that we were going to see any real recovery. Yet apparently most investors believe that there weren't going to be any concerns by about June of this year, when many were calling for a rebalancing in the oil markets. I said in January that that was going to be an impossibility, and still believe that is the case for this year. It's not going to be any rebalancing in oil until we begin to see some sort of balance in global demand. That global demand is not only Asia, but it is just that, a global demand, including America. America's demand is not going to be growing until we see manufacturing growing. Manufacturing's not going to be growing until we see good tax reform actually getting a little bit closer to happening.
Experience Dan Celia in person. Find a faith, family, and finance town hall meeting or seminar near you at afafoundation.net.
Welcome back. Dr. Everett Piper sitting in for Tony Perkins on this evening's Washington Watch with Family Research Council, where the news and views of Washington, D.C., as well as across the nation, are discussed on a nightly basis. I have a favorite author of the week. I stumbled across him. Somebody left his book on my desk. I don't know who. It's a wonderful gift. I started reading it. The title of the book is A Generation Abandoned, Why Whatever is Not Enough. The author is Peter Boileau. Intriguing book, fascinating book. And I want to have Dr. Boileau on the radio station to talk to you about the premise of the book, and I've got a couple quotes here that we might get into. Remember that the call-in number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234, and we will be taking calls after the next break. Peter, are you with me right now? Welcome to Washington Watch.
I am, and thank you.
Well, thanks for joining me. I don't know who gave me your book. I actually came into my office last week, saw the book sitting on my desk. I had been out speaking in a variety of different things. I was intrigued by your title. It actually parallels with much of what I have been bemoaning within higher education over the last decade or two, and that is the whateverism of our culture, the intellectual nihilism that we have embraced, thinking that everything is about us. I've even suggested that Carly Simon's song, "You're So Vain, I Bet You Think This Song Is About You," is emblematic of where we are as a culture and where we are as an educational establishment, because objective definitions don't matter any longer. It's all subjective. It's all relative. It's all about what we feel, what we want, our identity. We believe in the self, and we don't believe in the Savior. I was very encouraged by your book, and frankly, I hope I'm not being too hyperbolic here. It's almost Chesterton-esque, if you will. Every paragraph has a vibrant quote. I was underlining constantly. Great work, a great book, Peter. Why don't you tell us what the premise of A Generation Abandoned, Why Whatever Is Not Enough is?
Okay, I started out with three intuitions and tried to stick with them throughout the book, so they keep recurring as a recurring theme. And the first is, what's missing? What's missing in the air we breathe and the culture that we're now submerged in? It's like the Shakespearean, not Shakespeare, but the the mystery story about the dog that did not bark, but that becomes the clue as to who the assailant was.
The Oracle of the Dog. Oracle of the Dog, Chesterton.
Yeah, the watchdog didn't bark. This is Arthur Conan Doyle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so what's missing today is the first of three themes. The second one is then what has stepped in to fill that vacuum? What is the deception that we're being asked to live with or even forced to live with in some ways? And then finally, what is this confusion doing to the family? The confusion which leaves us sensing that, well, maybe whatever is the only answer to any question and that there are no deep questions. So the thing that's missing, it's even proto-religious, it's pre-religious, it's the inner sense of self-worth, and it's kind of self-worth, and it's a bad term for it, is the natural law, but the self-worth and natural law, which can be shared with others, the need, the desire, and the legitimacy of self-fulfillment, self-value, by relating to something larger than ourselves, to discover that within ourselves. So this is what's missing. What we've been taught instead is neutrality. Neutrality is not neutral. So in its place, we have a number of metaphors, we have figures of speech, we have slogans that justify killing of one another, that allow euthanasia as an legally as an exception to homicide laws, and that redefine realities of the human person, as in the parody of marriage, the redefinition of marriage, etc. So I'm trying to get at both what's missing, what has taken its place in the last few decades, taken the place of realities that we were instinctively aware of for millennia, and then what is this doing to the family? So that's basically what the book is about.
Peter, you repeatedly refer to the big lie, and you capitalize it. What is the big lie in one or two sentences in your view?
Well, the big lie is euphemism. The taking of a human life is called reproductive services. Euthanasia is called compassion. These signals that have been slipped in. There is a part in my book where I found a pamphlet some years ago that picked up a number of quotes, maybe a dozen or at least a dozen, of the kinds of things that were being said in Auschwitz about the killing of the victims. And the very, very similar quotes that were used in the early days of the abortion culture in the 1970s. I can't dig those out right now, but they're in the book. And then those have been replaced by euphemisms, healthcare, so on and so forth.
It's Orwellian doublespeak, really, is what you're referring to.
Yes, it is. It's doublespeak.
Yeah. What is the solution to the big lie? We're faced with these upside down. It's Isaiah, woe unto him who calls evil good and good evil, bitter sweet and sweet bitter. It's the big lie. In just a few seconds, what is the solution? And you've got about 15 to 30 seconds for it.
Okay, seconds. One is to realize that this is a cultural problem. It's deeper than political. It's politicized, but it's deeper than that. And the second is to try to create an environment where there can be a conversation with the victims of this culture. That would be the abandoned generation, where they can actually have a conversation, at least suspect that there's new ways, there are better ways
Peter.
At things.
Peter, thank you for joining us on Washington Watch. Again, The Generation Abandoned, Why Whatever Is Not Enough. I really encourage all of you to go on Amazon.com and pick up that book. We'll be right back after this break, and we'll have further discussion on this and other topics. The call-in number is 866-372-7234.
Your mission is to find Granny and get that sauce.
Affirmative.
1 million moms, in association with American Family Studios, introduces Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent.
I'm Ryan DeFrady's. I work alone.
Ryan is arrogant and reckless until the day he's paired with a very unlikely partner.
No way! I can do this alone, without anyone's help, much less my mom's.
Look, Ryan.
She's my mom!
Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent is the new action-adventure series featuring a young spy with a whole lot to learn.
Mama's coming,
sweetie. She's an agent. Get her, boys.
Each exciting, fun-filled episode teaches children important values, like honoring parents and respecting authority. And there's a brief wrap-up at the end that connects the story to a biblical illustration. Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent. Perfect for children ages 6 and over. Order yours today at ryansecretagent.com.
Consider serving with Friendships. It's an all-volunteer ministry providing aid to disaster victims, refugees, and the impoverished here at home and around the world. We're now taking applications. If you're available to serve without pay, you can be part of the crew reaching out to help people in need. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Life, Love, and Family, featuring the American Association of Christian Counselors President, Dr. Tim Clinton. Each weekday evening, you'll hear Dr. Clinton and his expert guests address important and sometimes difficult issues of our day that impact your life, your love, and your family, using the scriptures as their text. Access to archive programs is available at lifeloveandfamily.net. Life, Love, and Family, 11 p.m. Central on American Family Radio.
A boat ride on the Sea of Galilee. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman with American Family Association and American Family Radio. That is a highlight of our tour of the Holy Land when we go on the boat ride on the Sea of Galilee. A special time to be on the very water where Jesus walked, where he spent time with his disciples. And you know, in fact, you're the place where Jesus was. So many sites we're going to see in the Holy Land that are just like that. We know Jesus was here. The trip is in March, March 8th through the 16th, and we'd love for you to come with us. So many places we're going to see you've read about since you were a child. For more information, go to the website twholyland.com. That's twholyland.com. If you want a brochure sent to you in the mail, just call us at 800-FAMILIES, F-A-M-I-L-I-E-S, extension 5.
Welcome back to the Family Research Council's Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm obviously not Tony. This is Dr. Everett Piper filling in for Tony once again. Remember that the call-in number is 866-372-7234. That's 866-372-7234. 7234. I will welcome your calls in the next 15 minutes as we round out this hour. I want to pursue Dr. Boileau's premise a little bit further, and I'm going to read a couple quotes from his book. And I also know that he has stayed on the line, so when you call in, if you want to engage with not only me, but Dr. Boileau, you have the opportunity to do so, and we'll play that by ear. Again, the call-in number is 866-372-7234. The title of Dr. Boileau's book is, again, A Generation Abandoned, Why Whatever is Not Enough. Here's one quote. We cannot help but take note of the dumbing down of our common sensibilities. The subliminal suggestion and the redefinition of words cause an evolutionary mutation of how we understand and define who we are. Information on human sexuality, for example, is often bleached of moral content. Still, the tiny whispering sound of moral law and conscience leaves us wondering. We sense that names of real things are not simply arbitrary, that the act of being human and the act of human reasoning runs deeper than a dismissive whatever. The natural moral law is our personal assurance that we are not to be violated. Peter Boileau, A Generation Abandoned, Why Whatever is Not Enough. Does this sound familiar? Does this sound familiar when we say that words mean something? They define us. They define reality around us. Our definition as a human being is not arbitrary. We are the Imago Dei. We are made in the image of God. We are not defined by our fantasies or our fabrications or our feelings. There are facts. There are facts that define us. There are facts that define our sexuality, our gender, whether we're male or female. These are inviolable facts. You cannot violate them. We know who we are by virtue of the natural law, the common sense, the revelation of God, and not the construct of man. I've got one caller on the line. I'm going to read another quote here and then pick that caller up. Here's another quote from Dr. Boileau. A Chinese emperor was once asked what he would do to save his country. His answer, I will restore the meaning of words. The battle over words is more than semantic. It's about those who would rearrange the external world of others because they won't rearrange themselves. Great quote. The big lie is legion. It is to deconstruct reality, to live in a self-validating bubble, such as the delusion of the self-appointed vanguard elite. Another great quote. I'm sorry I lost track of the name of the person calling in. Scott. Scott in Virginia. Welcome to Washington Watch.
Yes, Dr. Piper. Thank you for taking my call. And there's so much that I'd love to say, but one, I would love to, if you have time before you get off the show, to read your article that Oklahoma Wesleyan is not a daycare, because we can never hear that too much.
Well, thank you, Scott. I appreciate that. We'll see if I have time to refer to that again. Go ahead. Any other question?
Secondly, I guess the question I have is, I was born in 1971, so, and I feel like I'm the only one that sees that the generation gap between me and my children is exponentially wider than the generation gap between me and my dad. And I really think it's society, and my kids are, you know, fairly conservative in their thinking. Thank you. Thanks to listening to the radio and me and everything. But do you find that's the case as well? Is the generation gap just getting wider and wider?
That's an interesting question. I think I might ask Dr. Boileau to join us here in a second. I'll give a brief answer, Scott. Great question. Appreciate the spirit and the attitude with which you bring it. You know, you're going to get a variety of answers. Some people are going to say that every generation looks at its current situation as if it's unique and new, but that history always repeats itself and there's nothing new under the sun and these problems have been around since the dawn of man. There's probably truth to that. In fact, we know there's truth to that. That's straight out of the Bible. It's Ecclesiastes. However, I do think there's something unique in the divisions that exist between the millennial generation and the older generations, if you will, yours, mine, and others right now. And I think as Gen Z comes into play, we're going to see more and more of a divisive spirit, more and more of a dismissive spirit. I would argue, we'll see if Dr. Boileau agrees, that it's because of the loss of objective truth. We have actually argued, let me back up, we haven't argued, we have actually taught our children that truth doesn't matter. We have taught them that there is no such thing as truth, that it doesn't matter what you believe as long as it works for you. What I would argue Dr. Boileau is pointing out in his book, and that is whateverism prevails. Not truth, not natural law, not self-evident truths that are endowed to us by our Creator and placed on every human heart. We have actually taught the generation that's following us that truth does not matter because truth does not exist. There's no such thing as truth with a capital T. All truths are subjective moral claims. They're postmodern constructs unique to the individual to the point where we can dumb down the definition of a human being to nothing but the sum total of his subjective appetites and inclinations. The person, the human person, is nothing other than what his proclivities are at a given time and a given moment. And that, I would argue, is the division between the generations right now. It's the loss of truth and the devastating consequences as the result of abandoning that. Dr. Boileau, are you there, and would you care to chime in?
Yeah, I'll make a quick comment. You used the word self-evident, and that comes out of the Declaration of Independence. The original wording that Jefferson proposed, and that was amended by Franklin, his wording was sacred and undeniable. That is translated into self-evident by Franklin, and now we have a Supreme Court that does not answer questions about the Declaration of Independence. They rely entirely on the Constitution, that they're constitutional lawyers. So there's a separation from either definition, self-evident or sacred and undeniable. And all of this has happened since 1970. 1973 was Roe versus Wade. So we have from the Supreme Court a rupture, and in several other parts of our culture, it really does make this period more than just a continuation of the past. It really is a rupture, I think, a generation gap that makes it impossible almost for young people to have a predisposition toward value rather than a predisposition toward neutrality and then just identity politics. Their sense of value and ours is being wrapped up in identity politics rather than an appeal to something that is universally human and a gift given. And it's not simply, you know, it's even prior to live different religions. It's innate to the human person. That conversation has no place to happen in an educational system that is value neutral.
I would use C.S. Lewis's quote, there must be a measuring rod outside of those things being measured or you can do no measuring. We have taken the measuring rod away from our children. We have handed them nothing. We have said, whatever, it doesn't matter how you measure right or wrong or up or down or good or evil or male or female. There's no measuring rod outside of yourself. You do all measuring. It's the original sin. You shall be as God. I think we have David in Oklahoma waiting. David, welcome to Washington Watch. We lost David. We'll go to Richard in Missouri. Richard, welcome to Washington Watch. Richard?
Hello?
Richard, are you there? Welcome to Washington Watch.
I'm there. Can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead.
Okay. You talk about discrimination. There's discrimination in Hollywood, the fashion industry, and in the networks. Have you watched TV or a movie show? And if a person's born male, regardless of their age, country of origin, or ethnicity, they have to wear a suit. If you watch Good Morning America or TV, ladies don't wear suits. They're almost wear nothing. And in our society, there's guys that are petite, and there's something wrong with them because they're petite. And there's ladies that's husky. Oh, there's something wrong with you because you're husky. You know, why is it that there's people, guys from petite families, and they're petite, and there's ladies from husky families, that's husky. Why is there something wrong with the person, you know, because they're that way? Why is it that a guy has to wear a suit and a tie if he's on TV?
Richard, I think you've got a good point. What I hear you saying is that we all discriminate in our evaluations of various different things on a daily basis. We have discriminating tastes in the way we select what we want for lunch or dinner. We have discriminating tastes with the movies that we choose to watch or not watch. The music that we enjoy, we discriminate in terms of the selection of music. When a guy asks a girl out for a date, he is discriminating in terms of the woman that he is interested in or not interested in. Likewise, when a woman accepts that invitation, she usually uses, quote-unquote, some discrimination in making those decisions. I would argue that, much like what I believe Dr. Boileau's pointing out in his book, words matter. And the very word discrimination has been dumbed down and manipulated and twisted to such an extent that it really doesn't mean much anymore. It doesn't mean anything other than bias or bigotry when people say discrimination today. It doesn't really have the full breadth and depth of definition that it used to have. And therefore, we've lost the ability to even have a discussion about how do you discriminate between a male and a female any longer. You can't discriminate based on biological fact. You actually could be prosecuted for doing so. Now you have to discriminate based on feelings and fabrications and fantasy and make-believe rather than what's real. Dr. Boileau?
I would just concur with that. Discrimination is part of thinking. There are differences. Gender theory is a violation of discrimination.
It's the denial of it, correct?
Yeah.
We actually deny that you can even discriminate any longer, but yet under this, it's like saying, I can't tolerate your tolerance, or I hate you hateful people, or I'm sure that nothing is sure. It's our discriminating view that you should not discriminate. So in saying you can't discriminate, they're discriminating against those that they find to be discriminatory. Again,
yeah,
self-refuting.
The only discrimination that's allowed is between political correctness and everybody else.
Correct. All right, one more caller. Judy in North Carolina. Welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you. There is a solution to this, and it's called the Constitution. It's the measuring rod. Same-sex marriage cannot be legal in the United States because in the Constitution, in Article 1, it clearly says that no ex post facto law shall be passed. Number one, same-sex marriage is not a law. It is simply 31 to 32 states were overturned by the Supreme Court illegally. They legally stopped same-sex marriage. They shouldn't have had to do that in the first place, but they were running so afraid because they needed to. So they went to the trouble, pain, tears, agony to pass amendments. Over 32 states did that out of the 50. And with one spoon, with these district court judges who can be removed constitutionally by the Congress, our problem is we're not reading the Constitution. And the only thing a politician has to do when they win office is promise to uphold that Constitution. That's all they have to promise. And with the ex post facto law, I looked it up in a law dictionary, and just one of the main things, it says that no law shall be passed. It's been defined that every law that makes an action done before the passing of the law and which was innocent when done, a criminal or I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm having a hard time seeing. In other words, to pass something after the fact, which is same-sex marriage, because we know that marriage is between a man and a woman. That's common sense. But it's also constitutional. So what is happening is the fact that the average person is not reading the Constitution. And just quickly, I know you got to go, but there's a book put out in 1937 by Congress with our tax dollars called The Story of the Constitution by Sol Bloom. And it was S-O-L-B-L-O-O-M. And in that, it says that the Constitution seeks to do God's will on earth as it is done in heaven. It also says that free speech does not cover blasphemy.
Judy, thank you for that commentary. I appreciate that. And I think your emphasis on the Constitution and the fact that we do have to have a measuring rod outside of the person, outside of those things being measured, is critical. And that's what you're pointing out and referring us back to the Constitution. Obviously, as a Christian, though, and many of the listeners, if not all, nearly all the listeners, would subscribe to being a biblical Christian, that the Bible, the revelation of God, which is also affirming of natural law, which Dr. Boileau references and our founding documents reference also, natural law, the revelation of God through natural law, as well of the revelation of God through the scriptures, is our guiding compass. And without that North Star, we are constantly going to be confused. Dr. Boileau, we've got about a minute or two left, probably a minute. I'm going to read a quote and have you comment it, and then we'll wrap it up. This is a quote out of your book, Dr. Boileau. To negotiate is to already have lost. Does the fireman negotiate with the fire? Rootless, sophisticated ambivalence is the big lie. Consent to that dialogue is sometimes an unwitting step toward unconditional surrender. When the air we breathe is sucked out of the room, when the truth is negotiated, smoke seeps through every crack of the walls. You want to comment on that as we conclude?
Well, one quick comment, and also referring back to the earlier call-in. Article 1, the Constitution, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. And what's happened is the judicial branch and the executive branch have established secular humanism as the national religion.
I'm going to have to give you 15 seconds, Dr. Boileau.
It didn't occur to anyone to deal with that.
Dr. Boileau, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it. Great book. Tell us very quickly, 10 seconds or less, how to get your book.
Okay. The publisher, I think, can give a cheaper copy than...
Just go to Amazon.com?
Amazon, yeah. A cheaper... phone number for the publisher, Hamilton Books, is...
You're going to have to move on, Dr. Boileau. Sorry about that. Again, this is Dr. Everett Piper sitting in for Tony Perkins. I thank you for joining us on Washington Watch this afternoon. Remember to keep fighting the good fight, because you know who wins.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.